Welcome back, everybody. Once again, it's time for another edition of the Brew University Virtual Roundtable Book Club Edition. And our summer reading series continues with another book club group ready to talk about The Go-Getter by Peter Kine. I'm very excited to talk about this book. This is a book that I have not gotten to spend a lot of time on with folks yet, but it's a great little read, and I have assembled a fantastic book club panel here to discuss it with us. So let me, as I want to do, introduce them all to you right here and now. And to kick it off, Great Wampus Cats, Brandy Clemens is with us. Brandy, welcome. Glad to have you on the podcast this morning.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And right next to her, a young infernal scoundrel, if there ever was one, Joe Walchek is here. Joe, welcome back.
By the holy pink-toed prophet, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else this morning.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear it. And oh my goodness, by the 12 ragged apostles, Phil Rolfe is here as well. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And the holy pink-toed prophet herself and the queen of the book club, Suzanne Borgia, is with us. Thank you, Suzanne, for being here once again.
Hi, bookies, and thanks for having me.
So I brought everybody here together today to talk about The Go-Getter, which is a book written back in 1921 and was lost to time for many years. This book had sort of been published, been forgotten, and nobody had really heard of it. But the term has stuck around forever. And it's one of those things that if your parents didn't say it, certainly your grandparents said it. But I've always heard the term go-getter, never really knew where it had come from or that it had an origin. It's one of those terms that I think is so ubiquitous and so simple and easy that you don't really think of it as coming from somewhere. It's just probably something that everybody sort of collectively figured out to say. But in fact, it comes from this book and was brought back into print by Dave Ramsey and his publishing group a few years ago, which I thought was fascinating. It was given to him by his mentor, and one of the things that we'll talk about here as we dive into the book, but there's an interesting parallel. This was given to him by a mentor who was 50 years his senior when he was just getting started. And the book will talk a good bit about the importance of young, ambitious people being a big part of what comes next in terms of leadership. But what's also interesting about this book is that it has not been altered from its original publishing text. So it is full of delightful 1920s slang and turns of phrases. It can be a bit of a tough read, especially at first, but I think that also makes it a very interesting read. And I think its core theme, which is success goes to those who do not quit no matter what, is one that can certainly be applicable at any time or place. So I'm very, very excited to talk about this one. And I want to open it right up to my club panel here and say, bookies, what'd you think? How'd you take The Go-Getter? What were your sort of first impressions? Any big thoughts you'd like to kick off with? And then we'll dive into some of the details from there.
I loved it. It was an easy book to read, and it had a lot of great points in it, a lot of challenges. My favorite challenge in the book was the Cohen, the spelling of the Cohen in there. So that was a lot of fun.
Which we will definitely get to. Yes, it definitely shows a lot of different challenges and the need to overcome them. What else?
Yeah, I thought the book was interesting. I mean, you have to separate out the fact that it's such an extraordinary tale. And then dive into the point they're trying to make. So that was funny to me. It became humorous to me. But I like the fact that not only are they talking about a go-getter and how, what characteristics make up a go-getter, but also touches a bunch on leadership and best business practices. So, I mean, although the main character and the main theme is how do we go out and be a go-getter, you can really take a lot of other stuff from the book.
Yeah, in my take, it was definitely a quick read. I don't know about an easy read. I do think the jargon from the 1920s sort of got in the way sometimes for me. But it was fun to think about this family business and how things are done in the 1920s, comparing it to our family business and how things are done.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in 90-something pages, and it is a quick read, but I agree, Suzanne, it's not necessarily an easy read. You do have to sort of push through the language, especially I found the first couple of chapters the toughest. There's a lot of setup here, and they're explaining the situation, and they throw us in the midst of a situation, and you kind of have to unpack that to get where we're going. But when it really starts to take off on the Blue Vase adventure that we'll be talking about, I'm sure, quite a bit, I do think it's got a lot of momentum that pushes it right through to the end. So definitely a quick read. I thought it was a lot of a fun read in many ways. Not exactly an easy read, and definitely a challenging one in terms of how much there is to discuss and digest out of this, because there's a lot going on in here. So thought we'd start at the beginning, and the book begins with our group of businessmen talking about the consequences of not getting it right when it comes to staffing. The first challenge of this book is our three senior statesmen of the company, and we're introduced to them. Cappy Ricks is the senior patriarch of the family, the owner of this venture, the semi-retired owner. And much like many owners we've all known, retired in name, but perhaps not in practice. Cappy is still heavily involved in his business, and he is scolding his two senior advisors, Captain Perry and Mr. Skinner, as their recent top choice, a man named Henderson, was sent over to run their overseas business office and has left them high and dry, having absconded with the bank account and fallen victim to perhaps a little too much fun without someone watching over his shoulder. So I'm curious what your thoughts were on Henderson and the initial situation as it's laid out, and sort of the first challenge that the book presents to us, which is what happens when you get the wrong person in the wrong seat on the bus.
I think it's interesting, you know, we fall down this trap from time to time in trying to define who should be promoted and for what reason, right? And Henderson, I feel like, all right, he was a great guy, he was a great lumber salesman, and yet here we are in this situation and what happened. And I think that Cappy kind of hit it right on the head when he said that he was a good man when he had a better man over him. And so, you know, the temptation to promote this person into this position because he had worked, you know, he was a great salesman and everything else. Did he have the leadership capabilities when he was unguided? Obviously not. So, you know, we see that in our business from time to time. You know, it's very tempting to promote the person who might be the best at the job they're doing. But did we really take the time to see what they're made of, to see if they could take on the next challenge?
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe. We kind of sometimes, in an interview, look at what they have done, but not if they are the right fit for the job that they're interviewing for. another aspect of that is we used to have our Minnesota operations, and a few people moved from Minnesota down to here or here to Minnesota, and that change in the scenery and where you're working can also be that's a huge change, and it doesn't always work out. So it's, you know, even going from Fort Myers to Tampa or from the Treasure Coast, and Joe, you know all about this. So you can talk about how different it is going from one warehouse to another warehouse. And Brandy, the same. You've gone from one location to another one. So it is different kind of going from one area to a different area. And will you succeed with those new people in that new area and all that?
Yeah, Henderson's described as having been picked, the man who failed at the job that they're looking to replace. He was the best at his job, and he had done every job that they had. And I think that oftentimes describes a lot of what people assume is what it takes to be that kind of leader as well. If they've done everything, they know everything, they were great in the role that they had. But as we see, you know, I agree, Joe, I love the phrase that he has about he was a good man when there was a better man over him. He didn't have that next level leadership. He had sort of reached his peak in the position that he had had, and they set him up thinking for success and ultimately turned out to be for failure. And I think that's it's a common situation we find ourselves in. And looking for that X factor, that other thing that at this point they haven't defined, but we'll learn is, you know, they needed a go-getter in that position is important. So they're starting to think about who they're going to pick next. They bring up a guy named Anderson. And Anderson seems to be cut from the same cloth. He's got the right experience. He's very good at what he does. But Cappy continues to hold back a little and suggests that, you know, they need to put him on a probationary approach because they're not 100% sure. And the other thing that I thought was interesting in this, and I was curious if any of you guys had thoughts on it, is they make quite a bit about the fact that Anderson is the older approach. He's a more senior, tenured, older guy in the organization. And Cappy pushes hard about the fact that age shouldn't be a deciding factor or a primary focus. Any thoughts or any notes that you guys had about Cappy's insistence on age not being part of the equation?
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about generational differences sort of with the leadership team. So that definitely came up here too. And if you think back to like this time, you know, the generational differences were affecting them as well. Just the different wars that happened back then definitely shaped those employees, you know. So that struck me as well.
I think it's an interesting time to read the book too, Jeff, with what's happening with retiring baby boomers at this point in our lives. And, you know, we've been talking about this over the past really 10 years, this, you know, get ready because it's coming. There's going to be, you know, the great retirement, and how do you fill it? And the answer is you don't pay attention to age. You pay attention to capability.
Yeah, it struck me as incredibly relevant as we are in this. And, you know, we're going through our own generational shift here within J.J. Taylor, and we see it happening across businesses everywhere, that, you know, this generation held on and has worked longer than any generation before them, right? Most of the previous generations retired out at, you know, 65, some even as young as, you know, 55, 60, in that kind of range. Thanks to technology and advancements in health and everything that's going on, this generation's retiring out almost 10, 15 years past that space. And so the gap between the person leaving the job and the person potentially coming in to get the job, you know, the 30 and 40 year olds feel like whippersnappers to some of these guys. But the truth is, some of them might even be younger than that. And I do think it is a important and interesting point that the book makes so early on as to say, age isn't the factor. Experience is important, but ultimately it's that X factor that, again, we'll learn is that go-getter quality that really made the big difference for them. And so I just thought it was interesting when we think about our own selection and how reliant we are on qualifications. It also made me think about our CDL program. And I know we don't have anybody from delivery on this morning, but, you know, when we put together bringing in people and building our own CDL training program, a lot of the thought was, let's worry less about the licensing and the experience of driving the truck. Let's get people in who are driven, who are customer service focused, and who want to do the work of moving the cases and delivering the beer and cleaning the back rooms. And then we'll teach them how to drive a truck. And that was actually the least important thing. And that flip has proven to be incredibly successful in our delivery retention numbers. And so, again, I think that program is an example here where we went and focused on getting go-getters and then teaching them the qualifications as opposed to taking the qualified and trying to find the go-getters within that pool. So if that model has worked in one place, I can imagine it working in others. And I think ambition should be the key there, which was definitely a fun thing to read. Again, from something that was, you know, what are we coming up on? Well, it's over 100 years old now, this book, so, which is crazy to think.
What shocked me there too, Jeff, with the age conversation in the book was, you know, what was good for the goose was not good for the gander, because the two presidents for each of their prospective legs of the company were hired young and given an opportunity young, and then somehow had been molded to believe that youth does not, you know, youth cannot run a company. So that was funny to me, you know, and it was interesting the way it was written, because as I was reading these first, you know, pages of the book, it was almost infuriating to see what was going on, because I'm like, no, you're messing this up. You guys are jerks, and you're boobs, and obviously written that way purposefully, so it got the rise out of me that it was hoping to get.
No, it's such a great point. Joe, you're exactly right. Cappy points out that he promoted both of them under the age of 30, and here they are complaining about Anderson versus other candidates, and that's, you know, arbitrary cutoff. But you're exactly right. It's that effect of forgetting that they got their start young and forgetting that when they started, they knew nothing either, and they learned it along the way. And I think that's, again, one of those challenges is when we're backfilling, when we're hiring, we have to think about who we were when we got hired as opposed to who we are now. There's that temptation to want to fill the job with the person leaving it at the point that they're leaving it, right? It's like, you're never going to fill the job with a guy with 5 years experience in that role when that guy got promoted. You got to go find somebody that's starting from square one again. But that memory loss of what the original situation was happens. And yeah, it's illustrated well there.
At the core of this book is, you know, you need to test your employees and you need to know when they're set up for these promotions, you should know almost beforehand, will they succeed or are they going to fail? And that was a problem. I think it's Andrews, not Anderson, by the way, is that Andrews was not tested. They said, one of the quotes is, you say Andrews has never been tested. Why hasn't he been tested? And that's on his boss. Why didn't they test him? And why didn't they give him these opportunities to succeed or fail? So that's, as managers, we need to do that and give our employees more and more to work on and see if they can succeed.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. We have to let them make safe mistakes. And that's the time for them to make mistakes and learn, is when they have someone over them that can help them clean up that mess. So absolutely true.
Yeah, it shows the need for consistency in leadership, because clearly we find out later in the book that prior employees had been run through a test and had been tested in a very particular way, and yet somehow Henderson had not been tested at all. And why hadn't Andrews been tested yet? So, you know, they're not giving the next generation the opportunity to come up. And yet they knew the process because it had worked several times in the past. We find out, you know, much later in the book. So why did we have that gap there? You know, and was that really Skinner and Peasley's problem, or was that a Cappy Ricks issue?
Joe, that's such a great point. I didn't even think about that when I was reading it, but you're absolutely right. We'll learn when we get to the trials of the Blue Vase here in short order that this is something that Cappy Ricks has been doing for a long time with many of his folks, and yet somehow, you know, the captain and Mr. Skinner had forgotten the importance of this and didn't use it themselves, and falling off that process, despite that process being perhaps somewhat questionable and a little insane, as we'll learn, but falling off that process and not testing their employees properly has led to these kinds of problems. So I think that's a great call out on this. So it's time to meet our real protagonist for this, I believe, which is William Peck, Bill Peck. He is the new employee who shows up on our patriarch Cappy Ricks's doorstep and is there for a job. And we'll quickly find out that he has scheduled his own interview, unbeknownst to anyone. After having already scheduled and failed interviews with Captain Perry and Mr. Skinner, young William Peck has scheduled his own interview with Cappy Ricks and is there to claim the job that he wants. And we'll talk a lot here about Bill Peck and how he gets his start. It reminded me of an old parable of the Spanish explorers when they landed in Mexico, and their captain set the boats afire in the harbor and told them, there's no going back now. We have to succeed here on this land. You're not going back to Spain. This is where we are now. And similarly, Bill Peck sort of burns the boats by having a business card made before he even has the job, and by being just completely committed to his idea. But thoughts and things you want to talk about around Bill Peck and how he gets this job and gets his start? Because I think the first sign of the go-getter begins with how Will Peck decides to get himself in with the lumber company to begin with.
I couldn't agree more. I still don't know if I like the guy, hate the guy, want to hire the guy. I have no idea. Still, I love the fact that he went in knowing who he was and what to how to sell himself. He did his research on who he was sitting in front of and made sure to lean on his, you know, military background, find a connection with the person he was trying to get hired with. So he was smart. I believe fully that he was a salesman because he sold himself first and foremost. But I'm with you, Brandy. I don't know. Do I like Bill? Do I not like Bill?
He struck out twice. This was his last chance. Or so, two strikes. He had one more chance, and He made it happen. He hit the home run.
And I think back then, too, there weren't so many hiring processes and procedures, probably, or different companies don't have as many, too. We strive for consistency and things like that. But I think back then you did what you had to do to get a job. So from a perseverance and confidence standpoint, you sort of like him. And I loved the business card section that he already had his business card embossed, which meant that he, like the same day he was hired, he showed the business card, which meant he had it pre-done to the interview. So I thought that was a cute little section.
And that's what I love about him. He basically says, this is my job, and he's already prepped and ready. And but then I start questioning, where does the loyalty lie? Because if you only have loyalty to one person in a company, what does that mean for all the other superiors around you? You know, I look at it like us, like if I have an employee that is only loyal to Jeff, but is not loyal to me or to Joe, then how, I don't know how I move forward.
Yeah, you never really want the step-up manager to hire for the managers below them, because you want that relationship engagement. So that's a really good point, Brandy.
So I will come to the defense of William here on his hiring tactics. And I will say this, I love the gumption. I love the ambition. He had a goal. It was clear to him. He envisioned his future and he manifested that future. To his credit, I think he tried to go through the proper channels, right? I mean, he didn't go straight to interviewing with Cappy Ricks. He tried to interview with Mr. Skinner. He tried to interview with Captain Peasley, but when he was told no, he wasn't willing to accept that the no was the no until everybody had told him no. And to that end, I do admire it, right? I mean, again, it's, we can say what we will about it. He did ultimately jump the chain, and he admits it. He admits that I'm trying here with you, Cappy, to get you to give me a job over their objections. But he wasn't willing to back off until he got that final last no from the one person who had the final last no to give. So in that sense, I do admire his persistence in the face of rejection and his willingness to say, well, you know, a no is just a yes to a question I haven't asked yet, or it's a reason to try another avenue. I do like that he was willing to invest in himself in his own future. I mean, the kind of business card, he gets this embossed business card made up for himself, could not have been cheap, and he had it printed long before he had the job. So he clearly showed a willingness to invest in himself. You know, he was never not polite or gracious. Even in his interactions with Mr. Skinner and Captain Peasley afterwards, he was still polite, respectful to Cappy Ricks as well. He always had a sense of decorum. He just was tenacious. He just wasn't going to let go of it until he got what he wanted. And I think also to his credit, he was willing to take anything. You know, he showed up to Cappy Ricks's doorstep and said, I know I could be a great salesman, but if you want me to push a broom around, I'll do that until something better comes along. You know, he had confidence, but without ego, and he saw any opportunity as worth it, and he didn't fight about what he was offered. He said, I'm just here because I know this is what I can do and what I want to do, and anything you can give me to get me started would be great. And he ends up with a good job, but that willingness to do whatever needed to be done and take whatever came his way and then make something out of it. He knew if he could just get his hands on it, he could make something out of it. I think is a nice bit of tenaciousness that really starts to define his go-getter personality. So I'm a fan, but I get where you guys are coming from, but I'm a fan.
I think it says something too about Cappy that, you know, they kind of describe him as a man who was willing to give anybody who had fought for the country a chance. But in particular, really took to Bill Peck. But there is a translation here that I wanted to touch on, back then to now and how we operate. There's an inherent risk for us to take chances like that in business. If somebody walked up to us, I just got sold a book of 100 stamps at Costco because the price was going up 3 cents. In hindsight, I paid $3 for stamps that I'm never going to use because I don't mail anything. So I would like to go back and hire that person from Costco, right? They did a great job of getting me in the moment. But if we just jump on every risk, Mr. Peck himself said, you know, if I can do the job, I'm going to do it better than anybody else. And if I cannot do the job, I'm going to take myself out of the equation. You won't have to fire me. I'll quit. Well, we know there's money involved in that now, especially today more than ever. And so I think there's got to be a fine mix when we look at employees today between that tenaciousness and what the risk, you know, the cost risk analysis is going to be on hiring somebody based on the fact that they might not make it, because I'm sure Suzanne could tell us there's a very real dollar value to that.
Well, that and sometimes we just want to hire for the job that's the broom pusher, you know, and the responsibilities and strengths that go with being someone who wants to push a broom are different than someone who wants to sell skunk lumber, you know. So you're right, moving around and the stability of transitioning employees all over the place just to get them in the door definitely has a cost.
Yeah, I do like that, you know, Cappy does have a soft spot for veterans, right? This is coming off of World War One, and you know, Bill Peck is a disabled veteran, and I believe it's Mr. Skinner that scolds him. Oh, you'll take anybody from the VFW that comes into our office, or the American Legion or whatever outfit he was referring to. What's interesting about that to me is there is that tendency of hiring managers to latch on to employees that have been successful and look for a trait like that. I remember at one point back in our Minnesota operation, I think we were on a hot streak of hiring former hockey players because they were tough and they knew how to take a hit and they had a teamwork attitude and they knew how to go out and grind and go fast and go hard. And we had had a couple of successes with former hockey players. And so all of a sudden the mentality amongst the management team became, you know, if you got a former hockey player, they're going to be the way to go. You know, I think sometimes we get those little things where I'll look for a former athlete. They've got that hard work ethic and team mentality, or look for somebody, you know, who's worked for this particular company before, because we know that company's great at customer service and it'll translate right over. So I think this is that 1921 version of that, and we all fall into it. But there is sometimes a truth in that too, right? There's a reason that other companies, you know, that we want to poach from them for a reason. So I think it can be a good indicator, but to your point, Joe, I also think, you know, there is a fine balance there, and it is interesting, right? Cause he comes in with, he's got some references and whatnot. He doesn't have a resume. He doesn't have any formal background. And obviously the methods and what we do today is much more involved. But to Cappy's point, and to his credit, he knows he's looking for something more than what's on the paper. He knows that, you know, guys who have served in the military have a certain set of discipline and willingness to follow instructions and whatnot. And he's had go-getters from there before. He's willing to take that chance again. So I think that's it's an interesting approach, and it works out in this one, but I can see where it probably has missed as many times as it's hit.
I think he was, you know, he was perfect for the 1920s. And we, you know, I heard Brandy and Joe say the same thing. Like, would I like him? Would I like him as an employee? And I highlighted one of these quotes while I was reading it. I think he would fail nowadays and fail working for all of us. He said, "I've been trained not to question orders, even when they seem utterly foolish to me." That is the last thing I want in an employee. I want someone to, when I make a foolish comment or a foolish suggestion, I want someone to push back on me. And so in this regard, I don't think he would succeed working for JJ Taylor or working underneath us.
Yeah, he's a total yes man. And there are companies that he would succeed at, but I don't think here, you're right.
We want pushback. We want new ideas, fresh ideas, and not that, hey, we're doing the same thing over and over again, because that's how I was trained and that's how we always do it.
And if you want to hear us talk a lot more about that, you can make sure to check out Tribes, our other book club series this summer, because we get deep into that conversation about the importance of having leaders at all levels of the organization. So thanks for the cross plug, Phil. That was perfect. The next thing I wanted to bring up is Cappy has a line that I think is so poignant here. And that is, whatever our faults, we must be fair. And he's talking to Skinner about Mr. Peck that they've just hired. And at first, Cappy tells, when he's speaking to Bill directly, he tells him, take whatever pay that Skinner gives you and be grateful. And Peck does. But then when Peck leaves the room and he's talking to Skinner one-on-one, he actually kind of goes beyond that and says, no, listen, you're going to pay this guy, you know, what you pay him to bring him in. But if he performs as well as Andrews, then he needs Andrews' pay. And if he performs better, he has to, and later does in fact push him to pay him even more than that. And he also takes the time to point out to Skinner that, listen, I know you're going to send him off on doing the most despicable job we have. You're going to make him sell skunk lumber and half-broken shingles and just the worst stuff we have in the catalog, but price it fairly. Don't give him a disadvantage by making it an impossible task about him and set him up to fail. And he sort of encompasses all that in this line that whatever our faults, we must be fair, which I think is an insight to some of what we would now sort of refer to as the core value that Cappy has about things. And I'm curious what your all thoughts were on whatever our faults, we must be fair.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't just fair when it came to pay and compensation. What I liked about Cappy in making the decision on what to do with Bill Peck was he laid everything out on the line for him pretty clearly. So as a leader, I liked that he gave, not once, but a couple times in the book, but in this particular instance, he told Bill exactly what was going to happen when it was going to happen. You know, the first time that you don't perform, you're going to be warned. The second time, you're going to get laid off for a month, and the third time, you're out. He also set that standard with Mr. Skinner on pay. He was clear. Here's what you're going to do. Here's how you're going to do it. We're going to offer him this much. You're going to pay him fair. So I think the quality of fairness, probably from his military background, really shines through and shows you that, you know, if you hold yourself to that level of accountability, your people will see it and appreciate that leadership trait.
I like that Cappy, you know, maybe Cappy overstepped his boundaries a little bit by going to, you know, his two managers. They said, no, you guys are going to hire Bill Peck. Like, you're going to hire him, but then he saw it all the way through. And by giving him the test of the blue vase, he saw it all the way through to see if he could actually succeed or not. And if he failed, then hey, at that point, maybe Cappy would have gotten rid of him at that point, because he took ownership of the decision that he made and he saw it all the way through.
Yeah, and I also like that, you know, he did go over Skinner's head to make the hiring decision, but then he immediately backed off and told Skinner, listen, he's your guy now. You're going to decide what to pay him. You're going to monitor his performance. You're going to tell me how he's doing. So despite the fact that he went over Skinner's head to get the guy in the door, he did immediately back off to respect the boundary of he's your employee now, and you're going to set the terms, and I'm going to push you to do the right thing, and I'm going to hold you accountable to doing the right thing, but I'm not going to micromanage. Which again, I think sort of speaks to that. There's an ethos there about there's a way we do things. And Joe, I do like what you point out that Cappy throughout, with one final exception that we're coming towards quickly, he is completely transparent and forthright about what his expectations are, what's going to happen, and what the consequences are. And I think in the heading of fairness to the employee, that it doesn't get more fair than that. Here's what I expect. Here's what you can get if you achieve, and here's what to expect if you don't, and all I'm giving you is an opportunity. I think at one point he even says, I didn't promise you a good one. I promised you an opportunity, not necessarily a good one. You're going to take what you can get and you're going to prove yourself. So it's, again, it's, he does intercede in certain places, but I think he intercedes always on the behalf of pushing his people to do what he believes is right, do what is fair to the employee, and to make sure that, you know, they're being aggressively fair with their team and with Mr. Peck in particular. So we've reached the pivotal moment of this book, which is the trials and tribulations of the Blue Vase. And this is where the book really takes off to me. Cappy, we find out, has this test, this little trial, his own version of the Kobayashi Maru, if you will, the unwinnable scenario from Star Trek. This is Cappy Ricks years and years before, comes up with his own scenario, and it's to go and get this blue vase. And this actually, you know, he tells Mr. Skinner that we're going to run this trial on this kid and see what's going on. And actually, Mr. Skinner is sort of the catalyst here, because that's where the setup begins. Mr. Peck is called into Skinner's home on a Sunday afternoon. Mr. Skinner is ill in bed. And in the midst of their conversation, Cappy Ricks intercedes with a phone call and says, hey, I need this thing done, and I need it done today. I need a blue vase that I saw at some store in downtown San Francisco, and I need it in my hands on the train by 7:55 p.m. because I'm headed off to a party where this vase will be the gift. And so no ifs, ands, or buts, get this thing to me and get it done today. And of course, Mr. Skinner, laid up in bed with illness, is not going to be able to do this task. But Mr. Peck, so coincidentally being right in the room when this request is made, is given the challenge and accepts the responsibility to obtain and deliver this blue vase to Cappy Ricks before it is needed for this party. And this is where we really start to take off. So I'm curious, bookies, what are your thoughts on the trials of the blue vase?
I thought it was impressive immediately, the line of questioning that Bill Peck laid out to Cappy. And it was detail-oriented, and it kind of set the tone. I mean, you saw it in his interview where he read the room. Well, now he's in a different position. He's proved himself and his merit through sales. So what's the next step? He shows being a go-getter is detail-oriented, knowing the task and knowing all the details. So he starts by saying, sure, I'll get you this vase. What kind of blue is it? How tall is it? What's its greatest diameter? Does it sit on a base? All of these fine details that he would need. He didn't question. He took the assignment on without, you know, fully understanding it, realized quickly, oh, wait, I need a lot more information, and got that information, and then repeated it all back to Cappy. And I thought that was impressive.
Yeah, it is a great example of making clarity a priority. And so often when we think of a yes man, which, you know, Peck certainly is to a great extent, we think of somebody who just takes the order and runs. But Peck does have the presence of mind to pause and say, let me get some clarification, not afraid to push back, not afraid to joke with his superiors. You know, he's built up a rapport and a trust. I think when he first gets on the phone with Cappy Ricks, he asks him, who do you want killed and where do you want the body sent? And, you know, so he's got a rapport. He's got a sense of humor, but he's also got a mind for detail and open communication. And he does. You're exactly right, Joe. He really pushes for every last bit of information he can get about this thing. And I think that's a big part of why he's successful, ultimately, as the story will go. What else?
Well, just even the direction, you know, it was like a left here, a right there. It's the second door. You know, I mean, thinking back at this time before cell phones and Google and MapQuest, and he talks about, I mean, as we get into the story, he has to call people and he goes and changes his $10 bill for change to use the payphone. And just those kinds of things sort of made me giggle a little bit. Just, you know, you think about kids these days, would they be able to handle it? They would handle it completely different. It would be on the doorstep, you know, from Amazon or something, not the local art shop.
Yes, this story, much like every Seinfeld episode I ever go back and watch now, could have been completely solved by a cell phone, right? That's one of those. That's one of my favorite games. Go back and watch an old Seinfeld episode and be like, oh, this whole episode doesn't exist. The whole Chinese restaurant episode is nothing if a cell phone is part of the group, right? But it's the same here, right? For want of Google Maps and some, you know, Amazon shopping list, this whole thing is a non-factor. But because of that, you know, again, he works with what he's got. And yeah, he's got to do a lot to get this figured out. There's a lot of little problems that he runs into, which we will, you know, again, we're going to learn that this is all by design. This is a test that Cappy has put together, made to be an impossible task, to see if he'll actually stick with this and be a go-getter all the way to the end. So did any of the particular trials that Bill faces stand out to you or spark anything for you? Because he does go through quite a bit of them.
I was going to say that he is, you know, one of the characteristics of Bill, two of them are that he was focused and he was dedicated. He asked the right questions, but, you know, we always want employees that, hey, Monday through Friday or Monday, Tuesday through Saturday, whenever our employees are working, we want them focused and we want them dedicated to the job. And the one thing that stood out to me was making those phone calls and then making the phone calls and then making the phone calls and then making the, he was so dedicated that he had to get it right and he had to get the right people on the phone. And he was focused on what he needed to do. He was dedicated. And, I mean, the discipline, everything. He wasn't going to fail. He was going to do whatever it took so that he didn't fail.
Yeah, he runs up against a lot. First of all, the directions are wrong. It's the store that he's told to go to is not the store that this thing is in. And so with a bum leg and a late in day time frame, he ends up walking like a dozen or so city blocks, store by store, looking in the windows of all of them, trying to find it, till eventually he finds in the window what he believes is the right one. Then he has to, of course, it's a Sunday afternoon, and this is, you know, 1921. Stores are closed on Sundays. So the place isn't open. He's got to figure out who owns this thing and how can I get in touch with them. So he reads the sign above the door and it says it's B. Cohen's Art Gallery. So he starts calling every Cohen in the phone book to see who it is. And I mean, the lengths that Cappy and his team have gone to make this difficult, they changed the spelling of the door at one point. I mean, they're swapping out the sign on the building in between his visits to try and confuse him and that he's got the wrong Cohen. He calls dozens of people on Sunday afternoons having to can you imagine the number of conversations that he's having to explain in every one of these phone calls who he is and who he's trying to get a hold of and why he's calling? It's amazing what they put him through to try and get this whole thing done.
I like the fact, too, that Bill, although seemingly in the beginning of the book, did not follow chain of command, once had shown his merit, kind of snapped into and did try to follow chain of command as it went through. He tried to call Cappy. He, at one point, reached out to his son-in-law, Mr. Peasley. So he was calling all the right people in the right order. He should do that. And then when push came to shove and desperation took over, he was going to call literally anybody or everybody in San Francisco to get this blue vase.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Joe. One of the things I noted is that, when we first hear that they're going to run the trial of the blue vase, Mr. Skinner tells Cappy, you might want to tip off the police this time so that you don't get this guy in trouble. As we will later learn, a previous attempt at getting the blue vase involved a brick through the shop window by someone who was so determined to get this thing. But Bill Peck never breaks the rules to get anything done. He never stops. He never gives up, but he never breaks the rules. He doesn't do anything he's not supposed to. He just... when he hits a block, he continues to, okay, what can I do next? It just never occurs to him to give up. Instead, it's just a constant stream of every roadblock where, you know, how far do I have to back up and what new direction do I have to go into to get something done?
In fairness, he was going to break one rule. He was going to break right through that glass window like one of his predecessors did. And the only thing stopping him was the fact that he had a police officer positioned by the front door. He had his getaway. Even when he planned to commit a crime, the man did it with, with planning. He had an escape car ready to go on the corner. He knew what he was going after. Give him props for that. But I think he would have broke that rule, Jeff, if he were given the opportunity.
Well, we'll never know, will we?
You know what's funny? The funny about this whole, when I was reading this book, I like visualize it. It was very well written. I visualize it and I kind of like see it in my head as I'm reading it. And it kept bringing me back to, I was like, oh, they could really make this into a standalone TV show, like one episode of like almost like a Black Mirror. But, you know, obviously it's not sci-fi or dark or scary, but it's like, oh, maybe Dark Mirror could tweak it a little bit and make it as one of their episodes. Because it was very well written. And he had to go through all these trials and tribulations to get to where he was going that... I thought it was very entertaining, and they could do something like that.
That's not a bad idea. In the age of content, I can't imagine. It is interesting that no one has made even a short film about this that I'm aware of.
I would say, again, just his unwillingness to take a no. It was kind of funny in a lead character, adorable way to see what he's willing to do. Because I do agree with you, Jeff, even though he might have thrown a brick through a window if he were given the chance, we don't know. I think he's a good guy. Somebody who wants to do right. But he was willing to tell when he got on the phone when he eventually got on the phone with Mr. Cohen and was having trouble reaching him, he told him, tell him his store's on fire. And then immediately got him on the line and said, hey, listen, your store's not really on fire. So I think it's fun to see like how far he was willing to take it to meet his goal. In an innocent way.
Definitely. One of the things that struck me the most is, we come to find out that the vase cost $2,000, which in 1921 was more than a handsome sum of money. And of course, he doesn't have $2,000. He's trying to figure out, how am I going to get $2,000? The store isn't going to take a check from someone they've never met on $2,000. And so he ends up effectively pawning a ring that he has in his possession that he had picked up during the war. And I found that moment fascinating in hindsight because he did that on faith. He did that on trust of Cappy Ricks and Mr. Skinner. They didn't tell him to pawn the ring. All Ricks had told him was get the vase no matter what. No matter what it costs, no matter what it takes, I want this vase. And here's the owner of the store. You know, he tells the owner of the store, this is on Cappy Ricks' account, as he was instructed to do. And the owner of the store is like, yeah, right. Cappy Ricks isn't spending $2,000 on a vase. You're crazy. I'm not letting it out the door without some actual money in hand. And so here's Peck taking probably the most valuable thing he owns and willing to pawn it on the faith that because he was doing what he was told to do, it's going to work out for him, that Ricks is going to pay him back and make good on it. I mean, there's a version of this story where he shows up with the vase as he's supposed to, and Ricks goes, $2,000? It was never supposed to be more than this. You got taken for a swindle, and I won't pay a penny more than what it should have cost. And he's out the money or out the ring, and yet he's willing to do that. And I thought that was a really interesting commentary on what it takes to empower an employee. You know, empowerment works when two things happen. One, the employee has to be empowered to make a decision like that and take action. And two, they have to have the faith and belief that their manager or their company is going to back that play when it comes down to it. I think that's one of the reasons that so often employees are afraid to do things in an empowered way, or they hold off on the trigger, or they're constantly calling to ask questions that we feel like they ought to have answers to, is they don't feel empowered because they're worried, if I make this call and it's expensive or it goes wrong, am I going to have, you know, is my team going to have my back? Is my manager or the company going to have my back? Are they going to make good on the promises I've made? So I was curious if anybody was struck by that as well, because it definitely struck me as his willingness to do certain things and put his own money and fortune on the line comes from both the sense of empowerment that he felt he had and the confidence that he had that it would be backed up if he did.
Yeah, I love that he felt empowered to make that decision. I remember when I was on the retail side of business with Walgreens, and my store manager had initially given me capabilities to do seasonal ordering. And it was kind of a big deal because they were large dollar items and you ordered them well in advance. And at one point in time, I had ordered somewhere near the tune of 700 of those stupid little reindeer things that you put on your car. Sorry if anybody has that. If you do, I meant to say that they're adorable. But those little reindeer things with nose and the two antlers in the windows, I misordered. I was supposed to order 60. I ordered 600. It was a big mistake, right? Instead of taking that responsibility away from me, my store manager at the time showed me how to go back and review the orders correctly, taught me how to store transfer items. When we had an excess, taught me how to mark down. So, I mean, I got a lot of life lessons. But the one thing she didn't do was take away my ability to continue to order. And I think that's something that Bill Peck saw in Cappy, was that he was going to be good for it. He gave explicit directions. He trusts me to make this decision, and didn't for one second think that he was going to get burned or in trouble for making a call. And I think it's critically important to people's confidence and ability to continue to do the job.
And you never made that mistake again, I'm sure.
But everybody you do for Christmas that year got car antlers.
Now I know what to get you for Christmas exchange.
Oh, gosh.
Let us know where they went on clearance, Joe. We'll buy them for the fleet. Every truck this Christmas of a red nose and reindeer antlers.
No, but Joe is right. You want to empower your employees. I mean, I don't think we have too many micromanagers here at JJ Taylor. I strive to not be a micromanager. I have trust in my employees. I want to empower them. I want them to go out there and make decisions. And then when they do fail, like Joe said, come back and we'll talk about it and we'll walk through the process of getting it right the next time. But yeah, we don't have the time in the day. We all have our jobs. We don't have the time to micromanage and go through every single little issue with our employees. So we want to empower them and we want to have the trust that they'll do it right 99% of the time.
Well, and that was the purpose of this test in many ways, right? Is Cappy Ricks is looking for someone that they can send off to Shanghai who's not going to be, you know, again, think about a product of the times. They talk about in the book is like, you have to send a cable back just to get an answer, right? So it's a telegraph across the ocean. The time delay in making decisions, if you're constantly having to check for permission, can get prohibitive in 1921. But today, because we have that little square piece of glass in our pocket that allows us to get an answer for anything all the time, I worry that sometimes we lose a sense of empowerment or we lose a sense of delegation because it's so easy for us to tell our employees, just go ahead and check with me. I've got instant messaging. I've got text messaging. I've got email. I've got all these. There's never a reason why you should have to wait to get an answer. And yet the truth is, all that's really doing for us as leaders sometimes is bogging us down and being the bottleneck and causing everything to be hung up on us. So, you know, it's in this age, it was critically important that their, you know, go-getters show the ability to make independent decisions and think for themselves because the technology was prohibitive. But nowadays, I worry sometimes that the quick access and the too much makes it too easy for managers to feel like, well, I don't have to let go because they can always text me and get an answer. And yet, are they really learning? Are they really growing if they don't? So I liked this little section that really sort of demonstrated the ability of someone to be empowered and take a chance. And I think it's a good little lesson to be picked up on. So thought I'd bring it up. Any other thoughts about the Blue Vase challenge so far? Things you had in your notes?
I like that Bill questioned leadership even when in the face of trying to acquire the money. So he called Mr. Skinner, who said, absolutely not. I don't have that kind of money on me. I can't get it. The safe's locked until Monday. I have no option to get you the money. Goodbye. He called Mr. Peasley and same thing. He's, you know, Matt Peasley flat out said, you're still working on that project? Go home. You've got to be dead dog tired. You know, give up. And these are his, you know, direct supervisors. And so it would have been very tempting for him to just say, you know what, my leg is sore, my body hurts. I've faced every obstacle. I'm going to go ahead and be done with this. But he continued to question leadership based on the direction that he was given and the task at hand. So I thought it was impressive. Because that could have backfired as well. You know, certainly there was some risk to Bill Peck saying, no, I'm going to continue to do it, even though he was kind of told you don't need to.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on that, too. I mean, to his manager basically was saying, stop, like this is you've given your report on the obstacles. Thanks so much. They're not excuses. Time to move on from this. But he continued. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that.
I kind of have a mixed feelings on the whole thing in general, because for me, my number one thing, loyalty is second, but my number one thing is trust. And so to put someone through this, it shows that you don't have a lot of trust in them. And then I don't know how you rebuild from that. I'd rather show you by my daily actions, by my test, by not my test, but my task, by what boundaries you give me to make my own decisions, almost how they let Andrews go over there to do a trial run. That's why I really love that we allow trial runs sometimes in some of our positions, because it gives somebody a chance to shine. Because sometimes when you put someone in a position, they can't do it, but sometimes you have to give them the ability to fail and get better. And then they become some of our greatest leaders, even when they're not really ready. So for me to put me through hell, basically, is what that poor man went through to prove his loyalty and ability to be creative and to get something done and never stop to be that go-getter. That's a hard one for me, because now my trust is gone in my leadership, because I feel like they didn't give me a chance.
That's a great point. So let's talk about the conclusion of this. So Peck does get the vase. He pawns his ring. He gets the vase. He has a friend fly him to ahead of where the train that Cappy Ricks is going to be boards at a stop by flagging that he stands in the track and flags this train down, boards the train, shows up in Cappy's cabin and says, here it is, the blue vase. I got this thing for you. Only to come and find out that the whole thing was a test, that the vase is not even worth that much, and that the whole thing was meant to test his mettle, to test his ability to be a go-getter. And really, I think in a way, designed to fail. I think most people are expected to fail this thing. In fact, we'll learn that only one other person has ever successfully completed this particular test. But there is a certain cruelty to this test, and it would not fly today, right? I mean, you could not put somebody through in good conscience what they put Bill through on this. I mean, hours of work and putting himself on the line personally and professionally to get this done. And while it does show who he is and his character as a go-getter, I do agree that this is not a test that I am recommending or anything like it. This is not something that I think we would do today. This is a product of its particular time, and there would definitely be a better way to go about testing somebody like this today. So how did you guys feel about the, you know, Peck's revelation? Because he shows a lot of frustration in that moment of realizing that this whole thing has been meant to just test him, as it were.
I thought it was interesting to see his emotion, because he was such a controlled character in the book, always kind of just putting one foot in front of the other. When you ran into a wall, come up with another plan. You know, as tears were glistening in his eyes, he wanted to beat the crap out of somebody. And I was like, swing, dude, you need to take out
swing on the old man,
you know, because that, you know, I felt every bit of his frustration at that point. So it was interesting to see him kind of fall apart there. And I think this is where I kind of had to reconcile the difference between the point the book was trying to make and the actual story. You know, it's obviously a massive, massive story built up way bigger than it needed to be, but still gets the point across that he, you know, he was able to cross the finish line. I think that, you know, waving a rolled up newspaper lit on fire in front of a train would garner some issues from our safety department, but he still nailed that task. But it was interesting to see his emotion run free at the end when this was all revealed to him. And I think he took it quite well, because I don't know that I'd be able to just be like, okay, cool, let's ride this train together into the sunset. I would have a little more conversation.
It was definitely, Joe, you're right, it's the first time we see him get emotional, right? He's a very composed character throughout, and he gets the job done, and he doesn't complain, and this is as close to a complaint as we have seen him get. I mean, that moment, as it's described in the book, when he learns that this whole thing was a farce, he's upset. You can feel it. You can feel that I just poured everything I have into this, and you guys are giggling. It's a joke. I think you can tell just how too far this thing went. And he does take it better than I would have, and he does ultimately settle down and take it well, which, again, I think, you know, the book has to, because it's trying to make its point. But yeah, this was not for the faint of heart, and this is not a route that I would recommend. I would not be sending someone into an account that I have told ahead of time is, I want you to make this the most difficult sales call of their life, and then walking in at the end and giggling along with the owner about it to see how they test their metal. Not something we would do today by any means.
I thought it was interesting, too, that at the end, the test didn't end there, which was, or maybe this is just because sometimes I'm an emotional wreck. I think it's because I have a six-year-old. The test didn't end there. So he's going through this emotional state. He's literally just learned that this was all some farce. And then Cappy asks him on top of it, all right, well, now explain to me why. Like, it's not just over. You didn't just win the prize. I'd have been like, no, I knocked over all three bottles, give me my damn beer. You know, like, I won. And no, we still have another part of the test, which was interesting, you know, where we find out the reasons why he, you know, gets the job done, is a go-getter. But I found it interesting that the test wasn't over when the test was over. There was still more expected out of him, and he composed himself, and he rose to that occasion as well.
Yeah, not only did he have to go overseas and for this new role, but he also had to go play one-handed golf after that.
So let me ask you this. Do you think a go-getter necessarily makes a great leader?
I think a lot of the characteristics of Bill were great for a leader, but excuse me, some of the things I said earlier don't necessarily make him a good fit as a leader or a good fit for JJ Taylor, like, you know, just blindly answering questions, you know, blindly doing what your boss says. That's not a good characteristic. But again, he's dedicated. He wakes up. I mean, he was dedicated, and he was going to do whatever it took to get the job done. And I kind of, every Monday morning, I kind of try to pep myself up for the week ahead. And like, I'm like, okay, what are the tasks that I'm going at? And, you know, what am I going to focus on this week? And kind of try to lay it out And I think a lot of people are successful at work when they kind of do that stuff, and they can lay out, hey, this is what I need to do. And even, you know, some of the classes that we've done with Brew University and Jeff is kind of like, you know, coming up with what are those three or four words that motivate you, and kind of just reviewing those words throughout the week or every morning. And I actually do it with my kids. Like when I get home every day, like spend 10 seconds before you go inside, take a deep breath, think about what you want to accomplish with your family or your kids before you go in, because as soon as you open that door, it's going to be a bit of a shit show. So let's just focus yourself and know what you're going into before you do that. And it's the same thing with work. Before you walk in that on Monday morning, you could be walking into a lot of issues and a lot of problems. So just try to stay focused and know what you want to accomplish. And whether it's for the week, for the day, or by the hour, I think that's some good characteristics of a leader and any worker.
Yeah, I think to answer Brandy's question, his character would be a great employee, having, you know, confidence, a goal achiever. I don't know that he would be a great manager. I mean, having those high expectations to get things, it shall be done, to get things done at all costs, I don't know that that's necessarily the culture that we have here. So no, not at J.J. Taylor.
So I think that the quality of being a go-getter is super important to anybody in a high achievement position. I do think you need that certain streak. I don't think it's enough on its own. I don't think being a go-getter alone is management material. But I do think that in order to lead a group, in order to tackle the objectives, you have to have a certain tenacity and a certain dedication to the mission and a certain willingness to get up every day and just say, I'm not going to let any obstacles knock in my way. Because ultimately, if you think about, you know, the functional job of a leader, the functional job of a manager, it's to get obstacles out of the way so that our employees can get done what needs to be done. And the persistence that Bill Peck shows in there is no obstacle I won't continue to knock on, I think there's an admirable quality in that. I think Bill would absolutely make an amazing sales rep for any of us, or delivery driver, or, you know, things like that, where it's like that, just that dogged relentlessness to, I'm going to get this done and I'm going to see it through. And I don't care if I miss the deadline, I'm going to do the work until the work is done. There is a lot in there that I love. And I think those things can be beneficial to somebody who's in a management role, for sure. But I do agree that I think there's more to it than just that, because at a certain point, you know, part of a leader's judgment is to know, when do we doggedly stick to and continue to push? And when do we call it quits? When do we look at a situation and go, we're not going to cling to a mistake just because we spent a long time making it, and things like that. So I think it's a great quality. I think it's a especially important quality as a young employee to have that kind of determination and drive. But I think with maturity and experience, part of what we learn is that, you know, there are other qualities that have to come into the mix. I do think it's in particularly, you know, again, in the context of the book, they were looking for somebody to operate in their overseas office in a position where they were going to be completely autonomous, where getting answers and asking questions and being directed constantly is a recipe for failure. And that's why Henderson failed. He didn't have someone directly over him who was really directing and leading him. And given how many roles we have that are of that nature, where we don't have day-to-day oversight of the people working for us, they have to have that initiative and that drive and that hunger, as Pat Lencioni might call it. I think this is an admirable trait, and I think it's a trait we should probably really look for and consider in our selection process. But to the original question, Brandy, no, I don't think it's enough. I think it's important, but I don't think it's enough if we're really talking about leadership and management. I think it's got to be there, but then there's got to be something more to it that also balances it and tempers it in ways.
We need Jeff to write a sequel to this book about him becoming a manager or being a manager, that talk about, like, you know, I feel like one of the—
I've got a 6-episode Apple Plus deal in development now since you thought this would make a good show, Phil. I already reached out and—
But yeah, I think one of the key characteristics of leadership also is being approachable. And they really, you know, they didn't touch on that in this book. But hey, if there was a sequel, they could go talk about that.
Well, I think he had to have had some sort of charm and I would say, approachability with the conversations he had with the shop owner, for people to do the things that he got accomplished. He certainly had some sort of charm and charisma to get those things done.
Oh, absolutely. He's a great salesman. The guy sold 2 quarts of skunk lumber all over the Southwest. You know, he's getting it done out there. For the right job in the right place in the right time, I think this is an essential quality. But I think, one of the things that this book does, leave absent because it's very short and focused, is it's not everything, but it is a thing. And I think it's definitely an important thing. So we learn ultimately that Peck's motto is "It shall be done." And he certainly lives up to it. His most remarkable attribute is that he never stops in the face of the challenge. He doesn't complain. He doesn't whine, doesn't curse. He doesn't collapse. He just keeps after it. Problem after problem, obstacle after obstacle. He just doesn't give up. And I'm curious, as sort of my final thought on what makes a go-getter is that tenacity to just keep after it until the objective is complete. How do you guys feel about that? And what's your thoughts on that sort of being the central lesson of this book?
I like that not only, it shall be done can represent quite a bit. But I like that he appreciated the fact that Cappy told him what to do, but didn't, the way he puts it, he did not insult his intelligence by telling him how to do it. I think that kind of encapsulated "it shall be done." Because it's not just the go-getter attributes. It's people are going to take a different route and a different path. And it doesn't always have to be spelled out for them perfectly to get to the same ending. So I think that's really important for us sometimes to step back. And Jeff, you hit on it with when you're talking about micromanaging and people out in the field. You know, every one of our employees does things a little bit differently. And I think that really is great. Especially when it all works in harmony. And so, I look at "it shall be done" as not just kind of a blanket statement. It's "it shall be done," and "it shall be done in the way that I need it to be done to work for me." And if that aligns with our company goals and values, then we have a winning combination.
Yeah, you nailed it, Joe. That was great. The way I'm going to do something is not the way that my employees need to do it. And I definitely struggle with that sometimes, as I just need to let go and let them do it however they're going to do it, and it's going to be fine as long as they get it done. But it doesn't have to be the way I would do it. Just give them the freedom to do it however they want.
I sort of took a different spin of "it shall be done." It took me to when we talk about the what versus the how. So getting the work done at all cost versus doing the work in a first choice manner. So I don't know. It left me with that sort of question at the end.
So maybe for us the cap would be to say "it shall be done the first choice way."
Yes.
There you go.
Well, I think we've covered this one top to bottom, and so I'll open it up here to just say final thoughts. And did you like this book? Would you recommend this book? And any other sort of final thoughts? I'd love to hear from everybody their parting bits on the go-getter.
Dave Ramsey says that he reads it once a year and finds new gems. I don't know that I will be reading it once a year. I do think it was a good story on confidence and perseverance.
I like the story for it being multifaceted and really, I guess I took more out of it, attributes that I'd like to look at in the interview stage versus, what can I do to be a go-getter right now? Obviously there's things we can all do to focus and better ourselves, but from a JJ Taylor standpoint, I really kind of dialed in to look at what do we look for in somebody? How do we test, the testing portion? How do we test in a small amount of time what somebody can offer? And I think that we have been encouraged to continue to look outside the box, take people out into the trade, put them in situations that they're not necessarily comfortable with, outside of an interview room. And I think that this book highlights that really nicely. And so if there's, the one big takeaway for me is it's important to continue that process, find outside the box ways to poke into someone's brain and see how they think. And then, we're all learning throughout the process.
Just remember, Joe, we don't pay for bail.
Darn. Can I use your earned it points for bail?
We'll take it. Yeah, we'll I'll get back to you on that one.
Yeah, the last thing that I highlighted at the end of the book was, it says, focus, dedication, consistency, discipline, hard work, integrity. These are the characteristics of a winner. This is what it takes to truly be a go-getter. So I really like that at the end of it.
No, I think it's a good book, and I think it's a good maybe book for somebody coming in an entry level, maybe even a young person, to understand how to be a good go-getter, or for perfectly placed people in J.J. Taylor.
I agree. I think this is a fun read, an easy read, a nice little motivational read. And I think, you know, it's very much the story it wants to tell, and it's focused on this one attribute of being a go-getter. But I think that is an attribute that fits the culture and the way we like to do things, the first choice way of getting things done and not letting obstacles hold you back and seeing it through to the finish line. There's a lot that can be taken out of this. So there you go. I think good lesson to learn when out chasing your own particular blue vase, whatever that may be. So with that, we're going to bring it to a conclusion here, and I want to take a moment and thank all my go-getters for joining me here on the Book Club podcast for this particular episode. Phil, you dodo boob, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. The book was great, and it was a lot of fun doing this.
Absolutely. And Joe, you unimaginative dunderhead, I appreciate all the time you were able to give us for this.
Anytime, my good boy, anytime.
Brandy, you jibber-jabbering jackjaw, thank you for being a part of this one as well.
Enjoyed.
And Suzanne, just, you know, let me know who you want killed and where you want the body delivered.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you all for listening. Appreciate you guys so much. Remember, we're doing a whole three-part series here this summer, so if you haven't checked out the other episodes yet, please make sure you do, because we've got a lot of these great one-day summer reads. The perfect book to take by the pool or lay out on the beach with and get a little leadership lesson while you're at it. I've been your host, Jeff Weaver, and you've been listening to the Brew University Book Club podcast. We'll see you on the next one.